In the chaos of northern Syria, Bashar al-Assad's troops have retaken large areas of territory. We look at how the Assad family has held its grip on power for half a century.
They've been playing this game before, using terrorism as a bargaining chip, as leverage. It's a very brutal regime.
Also, a violent scene unfolds as drug cartels shoot up a Mexican city.
I think what we're seeing are worrying signs of how organized crime in Mexico is becoming a parallel government where they set the rules.
And it's gotta be the shoes.
So if you're used to running in normal shoes and then you go out and you try them, you're like, this is weird. And I don't know if I like this.
But marathoners are liking Nike's new sneakers and smashing records. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. It's about an hour's drive from Culiacan, Mexico, to the nearest Pacific Coast beaches. Yesterday, Culiacan was a scene, though, of horrific gun violence for hours. Members of a drug cartel and Mexican security forces battled it out in the streets and continued the fight well into the night. We contacted a radio journalist in Culiacan who's following the story. He's not an English speaker, so my colleague here at The World, Maria Elena Romero, talked with him. She joins me now. Maria Elena, who did you speak with?
I spoke with Luis Alberto Diaz. He's a reporter based in Culiacan with an outlet called Línea Directa, and he has been reporting in Sinaloa State for the past 20 years.
Muy dramáticas las imágenes. Honestamente, yo nunca había visto algo así.
He says he has never seen anything like it before. The scenes in the city were just like very, very dramatic.
So what did he tell you actually happened in Culiacan yesterday?
He says that police were going on patrol in Culiacan, and then they were shot at. So they went and captured four people, and amongst them was Ovidio Guzman Lopez, who is the son of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, the Mexican drug lord that is serving a life sentence in the United States.
So what happened then was basically full-on war, violence out of control, and people were told to shelter in place.
Mucha gente pues ya no pudo salir de su trabajo.
Luis Alberto tells me that this happened after 3 o'clock, and many people were still at work, were at the bank or shopping, and simply they just took shelter wherever they could. It was full scene violence, shootouts, just people ducking under cars, trying to protect their children. So basically, it just brought the city to a standstill. But he says that the hardest part was actually that people felt that the city had been kidnapped. After the incident happened, they couldn't actually go back to what they were doing. They took shelter and slept in shops. He speaks about a Walmart that put the mattresses on the floor so people could sleep in. People opened their doors to others just to stay there and feel safe just for a minute because they didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, any of us here in the United States have seen the videos from Culiacan. I mean, it looks sadly like a mass shooting here in the United States going on for many hours. What is the atmosphere there today? What did Luis Alberto tell you?
Luis tells me that when he woke up this morning to do his radio show at 5 a.m., there was nobody on the streets. There was no police, just nothing, just like totally. He said it felt like a curfew had been going on in the city. But just a few hours later, he says, like, little by little, the city is coming back to normal.
So the police captured Guzman in this roundup of four suspects. What happened to Guzman after that?
Luis tells me that this violence that engulfed the city of Culiacan was actually a way from the drug cartel to put pressure on the police to release Ovidio Guzman Lopez. And it seems that it worked.
Now, in a press conference earlier today, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador defended that decision to release Guzman in Culiacan, saying it led to lives saved. Do people in Culiacan agree with that? What did Luis Alberto say?
Well, this is what Luis Alberto told me.
El presidente de la República, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, decía esta mañana en su conferencia.
He says that the response from
Oaxaca,
López Obrador is also unprecedented. He's basically accepting defeat. The Secretary of Security has explained that actually the police were outnumbered by the traffickers and they just had to give up. So this is something that is not reflecting very positive on Obrador's image.
The World's Maria Elena Romero, thanks very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
We just heard what the situation was like on the ground in Culiacan, fighting, ambushes, and cartels outgunning the police. Let's take a step back now and look at the rising violence in Mexico and President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's approach to curbing cartel influence. Deborah Bonello is a security analyst and reporter in Mexico City. She's reported extensively from Sinaloa. Deborah says the incident yesterday raises serious questions about the state's capacity to respond to cartel violence.
12 years into a government crackdown on organized crime, the military patrolling in what is the heartland of the Sinaloa cartel, why are they not equipped to repel that kind of firepower? We've long known how the cartels are armed and what they're armed with. The military and the National Guard should be equipped to repel that kind of firepower.
So, I mean, what we saw is the police releasing a dangerous player in the cartels. What does that tell us about President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's progress on dealing with corruption in the police force?
President Andrés Manuel has been completely inconsistent on this issue. You know, he came into power saying he wants to improve Mexico's security using hugs, not guns. But then he also created yet another militarized security force called the National Guard that was supposed to replace corrupt law enforcement officials from the previous administration and deal with the drug trafficking issue. That security force has since been dispersed to mop up Mexico's immigration disaster, which there's no time to go into now. He also said in the early months of his administration that the drug war was over, that Mexico was not interested in capturing kingpins. They wanted to improve the root causes of poverty and, you know, the socio-economic factors that drive young men and women to work for the cartels, you know, by handing out stipends and grants and improving education. They have launched some programs targeting vulnerable youth, there's no doubt. But he has been completely inconsistent on this issue. I'm just not sure that everyone's figured out exactly what his strategy is against the cartels, because the kind of confrontation that we saw yesterday is exactly the sort of thing that he said wasn't going to happen anymore when he came into power. You know, again, it's just kind of more confusing moves from a president who just doesn't really seem to understand how to govern.
Violence is on the rise in Mexico. Murder rates hit a new record this year. So would you characterize the violence in Culiacan, what happened yesterday, as a flare-up or a turning point in terms of rising cartel strength and influence?
Last week, 14 municipal policemen were ambushed and shot dead in the southern state of Michoacán. A further 20 people, more or less, were killed in a violent altercation in the southern state of Guerrero. The violence here is higher than it's been in Mexico's modern history. And yet, AMLO is making declarations about how Mexico is reaching an inflection point where things are starting to die down. I just don't see the evidence for that. And I don't think anybody else does either. I think what we're seeing are worrying signs of how organized crime in Mexico is becoming a parallel government where they set the rules. This conflict is rolling. And until Americans stop wanting to take cocaine and meth and, heroin and fentanyl, this will continue.
Finally, Deb, what has been the net effect of all the violence on AMLO's popularity, like today?
Impunity is kind of above 90%. So all people who are murdered or disappeared, you know, are often never found. Those cases very rarely go to trial. Faith and confidence in Mexicans, in their police and even their army has slowly eroded over the years. People are resigned to having to pay extortion to do business. People live in fear of local government officials as well as local organized crime bosses, because it's they who decide how things are going to be. You know, they are the law. And I think resistance is kind of futile. You know, the whole point of the use of this kind of violence, it's a terror tactic. You are not going to stand up against a body of power that you know can kill you, burn down your stall, kidnap your daughter. I mean, who would go into bat against that?
Security analyst and reporter Deborah Bonello speaking with us from Mexico City. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco. Good talking to you.
Athletes are always looking for an edge, a little boost to make them go stronger, faster, higher. In long-distance running, they may have found an answer in a new kind of shoe. the Nike Vaporfly. Some athletes say the shoe gives runners who wear it an unfair advantage. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
Got his shoulder. 140. 140. The unofficial.
Last weekend, Eliud Kipchoge became the first person to run a marathon in under 2 hours. On his feet were the Vaporflies. Nike claims the shoe can make you 4% more efficient. They retail for $250. And since the first Vaporflies came out in 2017, they've been the go-to shoe for pros and amateurs alike.
So if you're used to running in normal shoes and then you go out and you try them, you're like, this is weird. And I don't know if I like this.
Brendan Everett is an amateur runner in Boston. He's run 2 marathons now in the Vaporflies, most recently last weekend in Chicago, and he says they probably help shave minutes off his time.
The shoe is built kind of like a rocker, and rather than flexing like an ordinary running shoe, it has a stiff plate in there that allows you to do that rocking motion, I think, with less fatigue.
But does all of that add up to an unfair advantage? The IAAF, Track and Field's governing body, has been getting requests since 2017 to regulate the shoes. But when Nike recently came out with a new version of the Vaporflies, a group of runners who wear Adidas complained again. According to the Times of London, they said the shoe is ruining the sport. Thomas Allen, who teaches sports engineering at Manchester Metropolitan University, says every generation or so, a technology comes out that changes the way athletes compete. Think composite tennis rackets or the full-body swimsuits that reduce drag. The tennis rackets are allowed, by the way, but those swimsuits were banned from competition.
But really, it comes down to what are the rules of that particular sport. And then if a piece of equipment falls outside of those rules, then it can't be used. And then that would essentially then be considered cheating.
But Allen says exactly where to set those rules when it comes to technology is difficult.
Because we've been designing running shoes for a long time. And the manufacturers will claim that every time they bring out a new shoe, it's better than the previous. Then every time, you could argue that we're having some kind of technology doping.
Allen says with the Vaporflies, it may be too late to reel this latest technology back in. Nike has patented the design, sure, but it's only a matter of time, he says, before other manufacturers come up with their own versions. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
And speaking of remarkable human achievements, 2 NASA astronauts made history today and took the first ever all-female spacewalk.
Great view here of both Christina Cook on the end of the robotic arm with the red stripes on the legs of her spacesuit and just visible below her, Jessica Meir.
That was a commentator with NASA TV. Christina Cook and Jessica Meir floated outside the International Space Station to replace defective equipment. Even though it looks like they're floating, a spacewalk is one of the most physically challenging things an astronaut can do.
You can perform a safety tether swap onto the SSRMS. First lock your green hook, and then relocate your yellow hook to the SSRMS Lee forward tether point.
Copy that.
14 other women have done spacewalks, but always with male astronauts. Catherine Sullivan was the first American to do it 25 years ago. She reflected on today's accomplishment.
In terms of getting an important job done, it's that the gender makes no difference at all. These are two superbly trained professionals who will, I'm sure, have no problems. But in terms of the inspirational value and a moment in time to reflect on how women's roles have grown and expanded in the space program, I think it's a very quite significant moment. I hope lots of young people all around the world are watching and maybe raising their sights on what they think they can accomplish themselves.
The 2 astronauts, Christina Cook and Jessica Meir, spoke on the phone this afternoon with President Trump. They said they were just doing their jobs.
There's been a long line of female scientists, explorers, engineers, and astronauts, and we have followed in their footsteps to get us where we are today.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Shelling and gunfire continued in northern Syria today, a day after Vice President Mike Pence said Turkey had agreed to a 5-day pause in the fighting to stop attacking Kurdish-led militia. A spokesman for the Kurdish forces, Mustafa Bali, said Turkey is continuing to pound civilian areas as well as a hospital in northern Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan spoke to reporters in Istanbul today and disagreed with those reports. Erdogan said, "I do not know where you receive information from, but according to the information I get from my defense minister, there are no ongoing clashes." He said reporters have misinformation. President Trump said no shots are being fired and the Kurds are very happy.
I just spoke to President Erdogan of Turkey. We're doing very, very well with Turkey. There's a ceasefire or a pause or whatever you want to call it. There was some sniper fire this morning. There was mortar fire this morning that was eliminated quickly. And they're back to the full pause.
The deal brokered by the Trump administration is a victory for Turkish President Erdogan. It gives Turkey a sphere of influence in northern Syria. Trump has also handed a gift to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Assad has been suppressing a rebellion in Syria with brute force for 8 years. In the chaos of the past 2 weeks, Assad has regained control of nearly a third of Syria. I sat down with correspondent Sam Dagger to talk about just how the Assad family has managed to remain in power for decades. Dagger is the author of Assad or We Burn the Country, How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria.
They've been around for 50 years. They've outlasted 8 U.S. presidents since Richard Nixon. So they've been playing this game before, using terrorism as a bargaining chip, as leverage in their dealings with Western powers. Right after 9/11, Bashar al-Assad initially sent a letter to George Bush saying, "I want to cooperate with you. I want to help you, you know, fight al-Qaeda." In fact, for a short period, the infamous CIA rendition planes were making stops in Damascus, handing over al-Qaeda suspects to be tortured in regime prisons. So initially, he was cooperating with the U.S. in the fight against terrorism. Then he feels threatened after the swift toppling of Saddam Hussein. What does he do? He supports the insurgents in Iraq. And then he rounds up all the jihadists that he had helped get to Iraq through Syria, puts them in prison, and gets, as a result, some sanctions relief from the Americans. John Kerry met with him at least 5 times between 2008 and 2009. And he gets sanctions relief. He begins to be, again, treated as a reformer who's trying his best in this difficult neighborhood. And then fast forward to the uprising 2011. The first thing he does a month into the uprising is he releases more than 1,000 militants from prison that he had put in prison, you know, a couple of years before.
So to the question, how has the Assad family been able to remain in power for nearly half a century? It sounds like you're saying through a kind of extortion scheme.
Absolutely. So the extortion in its dealings with the outside world, with Western powers, but domestically, it's a very brutal regime. I mean, they have one of the most elaborate police state system in place. We're talking about intelligence services made up of 4 directorates. Every directorate has branches in every city and town.
The Mukhabarat.
Precisely. So your neighbor is watching you. I mean, your neighbor is calling the Mukhabarat saying, you know, "I saw something suspicious." And I was told by people in Germany that the infamous Stasi, the secret police in East Germany, former East Germany, helped Hafez al-Assad, the father, construct the Mukhabarat.
So now with a family in Damascus that has kind of taken to co-opting terrorists for their own goals, now these ISIS fighters are fleeing from prisons formerly held by the Kurds. I mean, what do you see happening now?
Yeah, I mean, this is the biggest worry. We don't have evidence of it yet, but last December 2018, when President Trump announced he was leaving Syria, if you recall.
Yeah.
But then his generals and the defense secretary intervened, and he basically dialed back and he said, we're going to leave, you know, at least 1,000. And at the time, some French officials, senior French officials of the Macron administration that I'm in touch with, I met with them in Paris, and they told me that one of their biggest worries at the time was that the YPG, the Kurdish faction that both the French and the Americans and the Brits and other Western powers had been cooperating with to fight ISIS, had begun talks with the Assad regime. And one of the things that the Assad regime, and again, this is based on French intelligence,
right,
one of the things that the Assad regime had asked for from the YPG was give us some of these ISIS prisoners, particularly the ones that have, you know, French or British citizenship, and we will take them.
And why did they want them, did they say?
To basically use them as leverage to extort France and Britain, and to say to France and Britain, either you remove sanctions on us, because, again, you have to remember also the Russians at the time had been asking the French and the Germans to pay for the reconstruction of Syria, and they had balked. And Assad would basically tell the French, look, I have your citizens. I mean, effectively, these are like French and British and European citizens. They're in my prisons. What do you want me to do with them? Keep them or send them back to you, basically? If you want me to keep them, then you have to remove sanctions. You have to give me some money to rebuild parts of Syria that he and his main backer, Russia, had basically destroyed in their scorched earth campaigns. And also potentially reopen your embassies. So that's the game he would play. And that's what the French officials told me. I mean,
that was their concern.
That was their main concern, yes.
I'm speaking with Sam Dagher, who is the author of Assad or We Burn the Country. You've been detained in a Syrian prison. You've seen brutality in many corners of Syria up close. Do you think we here in the West appreciate just how ruthless the Assad regime is?
I don't think so. Because, again, you have to remember, the image we see is this soft-spoken, fit, tall, professional eye doctor with a beautiful wife, born in Britain, speaks flawless English with a British accent. And we say, oh, they look like us. I mean, look at his children. Even his kids are like, you know, this picture-perfect family. They could be anywhere. They could be in Europe. It could be like the Danish ruling family or something. And then we find it hard to believe that someone like that would commit all these crimes.
Yeah, what did you experience that suggests the exact opposite of that image?
Again, I mean, I spoke to people who were inside the regime, in the inner circle, who were explaining to me the tools of the deception, basically, how all of this was orchestrated before the death of his father, Hafez al-Assad. It was a way for this regime to reinvent itself, to repackage itself. I mean, you have to remember the context of all of this in 2000. A decade before the Berlin Wall had fallen in 89, the Soviet Union had unraveled, the Soviet Union being the main military and political backer of the Syrian regime. And the Syrian regime had to pivot to the West, had to reinvent and repackage itself. And everything they did was very deliberate, including the choice of this wife, of this match between Bashar and Asma al-Assad.
Sam Dagher, the author of Assad or We Burn the Country, How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria. It's great to finally meet you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Marco.
Protesters in Hong Kong have been carrying stuffed animals, plush green frogs.
Pepe is a symbol of this revolution. I've got an energy from Pepe.
Energy from Pepe the Frog. Yep, that Pepe, the symbol of white nationalism in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Pepe's Hong Kong comeback, that's still ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. At one time, a green bug-eyed cartoon seemed mostly harmless, appearing in all sorts of memes, but social media can be a cesspool of awfulness. Take Pepe the Frog. The alt-right movement in the U.S. adopted Pepe during the 2016 presidential election. He was used in racist and anti-Semitic messages. And that pretty much killed Pepe's chances for any mass appeal here. But Pepe is emerging once again as a political icon, this time in Hong Kong. The World's Patrick Nguyen tries to figure out why.
A year ago, if you told me I was headed to a rally full of people shouting and waving Pepe dolls, I would have been kind of freaked out. And I definitely would not have guessed that they'd be chanting in Cantonese. Reclaim Hong Kong, they're saying. The revolution of our times. If you think about Hong Kong's protests, you might think about millions of protesters marching in all black, or riot cops and tear gas. But you should also think about Pepe the Frog.
Pepe is a symbol of this revolution. I've got an allergy from Pepe.
That's Mulk. She's 32, a clerk at a dental clinic. She's excited for this rally, Pepe doll in hand, and she's not the only one fired up. There are thousands at this unlawful protest, and hundreds of Pepe signs and Pepe dolls, and drawings of this frog scowling or crying out in anger. I turn to another protester named Mandy, asking her to help make sense of this.
Can you tell me about Pepe?
It's hard to explain. We like to use Pepe in our social media to express what we are thinking. He's famous now. He's very famous.
She's right. Pepe is famous, and also this is hard to explain, especially to anyone having flashbacks of the last U.S. presidential race when you would turn on CNN and hear something like...
Donald Trump Jr., for example, he put this image on his Instagram account. It's a meme of Pepe. And for those of you who don't know, Pepe is a white nationalist symbol.
But he didn't start out that way. Pepe is not from a TV show or a movie. He's just a drawing, first posted to MySpace about 15 years ago. People love to redraw the frog with different facial expressions or outfits. Just silly, harmless fun. Or it was until the alt-right embraced Pepe and put him in Nazi uniforms, and during the 2016 campaign had him saying atrociously dark racist stuff. Pepe even popped up in the social media feeds of Donald Trump and his son, which made Hillary Clinton say,
"He is taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the Republican Party."
So, yeah, in the U.S., Pepe has major baggage. But in Hong Kong? Well, when I wade into this noisy crowd and ask about Pepe's background...
Did you know in the United States he has a different meaning?
Actually, I don't know.
You never heard about that?
Yes, I've never heard about this.
I can't find a single person here who knows anything about Pepe's dark side. Everyone says he's just that internet frog. We like him, so we adopted him. When they do stumble across some creepy alt-right rendition of Pepe, they are baffled. Like, why are Americans making Pepe so disturbing?
He's come from U.S., right? And I saw the photo. It's Pepe killing himself.
Killing himself. But the Hong Kong portrayal of Pepe is not like that. There, Pepe is a heroic freedom fighter, enraged by police violence. And sometimes, female. Protesters with Pepe dolls like to put the frog in a dress with a bloody bandage over her eye, so she can represent one of their martyrs, so to speak. It's a fellow protester who didn't die, but her eye was badly wounded when police shot her point blank with a beanbag round. That is her, in an online video, disguising her voice to stay anonymous, telling everyone she is too injured to keep fighting. Now her admirers bring out these Pepe frogs in her likeness, so through Pepe, she can be there in spirit.
This one, you can see that one of the eyes hurt, and then...
It's representing the girl who is hurt in the movement. Yes.
This is the enduring power of this bug-eyed frog. For some reason, Pepe seems to draw out whatever is inside you. If you're a racist, you turn Pepe into a Nazi. If you're a Hong Kong protester, you turn Pepe into a crusader against police brutality. The movement hasn't successfully reclaimed the city. But in a way, Hong Kongers, without fully realizing it, are reclaiming Pepe from racist in America. They've reformed Pepe. In fact, they don't even really call him Pepe.
Pee-pee. Yeah, pee-pee.
The Hong Kongers say pee-pee or Pepe?
Pee-pee. Yeah, pee-pee.
So, sorry, white nationalist. Pepe, or pee-pee, is now a young Cantonese-speaking woman seeking vengeance from the cops. For now, at least. Because, as one of the protesters, Mandy, is quick to point out, pee-pee is always subject to change.
He can express all emotion. But nowadays, maybe he is sad. And you can see his face. It's full of sadness. But I hope he will become happy in the near future. Yeah.
For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Hong Kong.
A massive polio vaccine campaign launched this week in the Philippines, with people going door-to-door giving kids droplets of an oral vaccine. Crying, the universal reaction of kids everywhere forced to swallow medicine. After being polio-free for nearly two decades, the disease has returned to the Philippines. Two cases were identified last month. Polio can cause paralysis. There is no cure. So now the Philippines is trying to vaccinate more than a million children under the age of five. Heidi Larson has been directly involved with the global campaign to eradicate polio. She heads the Vaccine Confidence Project at the London School of Tropical Medicine. She says the Philippines is experiencing something called vaccine-derived polio.
It doesn't mean that when you take the vaccine, you immediately get it, but it's a live virus, which sounds a bit complicated, but it's very little of it, so it doesn't make you sick, but it goes right through you into the environment. And if there's no protection in the environment, that live virus can travel to somebody else. And the cases that came up in the Philippines actually came from that process because they didn't have that protective cover that the vaccine allows when everybody gets it.
So let me get this straight, Heidi. You're saying, for example, a Filipino kid got vaccinated with this live polio vaccine and then, I don't know, urinated, and that goes into the water stream and then other people drink that?
Yes, it's not through urination. It's through bowel, and it gets into the water and starts to circulate. And we've seen that happen in a few places. And part of the reason it's happening is because we've eliminated the wild virus from most of the world. So when it does circulate, it becomes much more potent.
So you're basically saying the virus from the vaccine caused this resurgence in the Philippines?
Yes.
In addition, there were low vaccine rates and mistrust to begin with. How did that start?
Well, in 2017, the country, which has a very big burden, as they call it, of dengue virus, which is a really bad fever, and people call it bone-breaking disease. It's very painful. It can kill children. And
it's transmitted by a mosquito?
Yes. It's like malaria, but it's interestingly transmitted at a different time of day than malaria. So because Brazil and the Philippines had some of the worst dengue in the world, when there was a new vaccine available that could prevent it, those were the two countries that really started to introduce it. But a year later, the manufacturer who makes the vaccine sent out an announcement and said, we've just learned that there is a small risk that this vaccine can create more severe dengue if you've never been exposed to dengue before. So that created a panic in the population.
And that was not a rumor. That is, in fact, true. Is that right?
That was true. And that's another challenge with building vaccine confidence, is that there are risks for vaccines. I mean, there's risks in just about any medicine you take. But this was a real risk. And there are ways to manage it. You just need to make sure that the people who get the vaccine have had some kind of exposure. And that can just mean living in an area that has a lot of dengue. But they did stop the vaccination campaign. And it really scared the public.
So now the government of the Philippines has this big vaccine drive going on. This week it started. How's that going? Do you see any problems?
So far it's going well. And there's been a big investment in trust building, and we've gone back and resurveyed in the population. What are you thinking about vaccines? Do you think they're safe? Do you think they're effective? Do you think they're important? And actually, the confidence is starting to come back.
Heidi Larson heads the Vaccine Confidence Project at the London School of Tropical Medicine. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
12 years ago today, we lost musician Lucky Dube, a South African reggae star and a star among reggae fans around the world. But beyond that, not very well known.
Didn't know she was crying until now.
Today, it's fair to say that Lucky Dube has not slipped into obscurity, but he's been certainly obscured by other late reggae artists like Bob Marley and Peter Tosh. I recently stumbled across one surprising place, though, where Lucky Dubé is bigger than ever.
In the remote Aboriginal communities of Central Australia, he was bigger than the Beatles.
Still is. That's from the podcast Earshot from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, an uplifting story about how Lucky Dubé remains popular in the outback, and how shortly before he died, he was a source of a unique Aboriginal style, desert reggae. It all started with a single cassette from South Africa. Australian musician Jason Butcher is lead guitarist for the Aboriginal reggae group, the Cheapy Band.
I was this little boy playing outside and I heard the first song, Victim. It just made me feel the beat and I wanted to listen to it over and over. I went and sit next to my father and I asked, who's that? And he told me, that's Lucky Dubé.
Lucky's songs like this one, called Victims, dealt with topics from colonial oppression to family breakdown to social problems caused by poverty. That resonated in Aboriginal communities in Central Australia, places like Alice Springs. ABC reporter Rhiannon Stevens picks up the story some 10 years after that Lucky Dubé cassette began circulating.
Scott Bucock, a young entrepreneur, was looking to bring a big-name international act to Alice Springs. He'd been throwing around suggestions with his friend, Reggae Joe Miller, who hosted a reggae show at the Aboriginal radio station Karma.
And then suddenly, it was just one day, he said, well, what about Lucky Dubé? I said, Lucky Dubé? I said, who's Lucky Dubé? Joe said to me, Scotty, this guy, he's just going to attract all this attention and all this. And of course, I just couldn't Google it back then. You just didn't know.
But Joe had been hearing Lucky's popularity grow over the airwaves of Central Australia.
Lucky Dubé was one of the favourites. And then the community relate to all the songs and they always requested Lucky Dubé's songs. And he gets very, very popular. And for example, like Slave. I want a slave. A slave.
I'm a slave. I'm a legal slave. The promoter, Scott Bucock, took the advice of his DJ friend, and in 2005 he brought Lucky Dubé to the outback. The risk paid off. Here's Bucock again.
So Lucky stood on that stage when we arrived. He stood there and he didn't say a word. It was one of those moments where you think he's standing in the middle of Australia and he's about to do a concert in front of a very large Indigenous audience, because at that point we knew how big it was going to be because of all the buses that were registered to come in. And I'll never to this day know what he was thinking, but I'm guessing he was thinking it was a very special moment.
It's a very good guess. Lucky did two more shows on that tour. The reception was so good, Bucock planned to bring him back a year later. In 2007, though, on October 18th, Lucky Dubé was killed outside Johannesburg.
The 43-year-old musician was shot and killed as he was dropping his son off close to the centre of the city. Police believe he may have been the victim of a carjacking attempt, and they're searching for three suspects.
Lucky Dubé was not forgotten in the Australian outback. He was the inspiration for a generation of desert reggae bands, like Jason Butcher's Cheapy Band.
It wasn't for Lucky Dubé, we wouldn't be playing reggae today. We would be still playing rock and blues and country. And I think he must be looking down to us and smiling and telling us to keep playing music.
So in honor of South Africa's Lucky Dubé, here's part of his legacy in Australia, the Cheapy Band. Big thanks to the ABC and reporter Rhiannon Stevens for sharing that story with us and with you. To listen to all 30 minutes of our podcast, come to our Facebook or Twitter page. We are at PRI The World. You're listening to The World. I'm Orca Werman. This is The World. They did it. The British government struck a deal with the European Union and found a way to extract the UK from the European club. That is, if Parliament agrees. The House of Commons meets tomorrow to debate the Brexit deal. It's the first time Parliament has sat on a Saturday since 1982 during the Falklands War. The stakes tomorrow could not be higher, and the outcome is by no means certain. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been beseeching members of Parliament to support his new deal.
I hope very much now that my fellow MPs in Westminster do now come together to get Brexit done, to get this excellent deal over the line, and to deliver Brexit without any more delay so that we can focus on the priorities of the British people.
Okay, so what now? The World's Orla Barry joins us from London. Orla, another week full of twists and turns for Brexit, but finally, there is a deal. The end is in sight, I think.
If only, Marco, if only. I heard one MP saying earlier it's like the TV series 24 with Jack Bauer, that each hour is another cliffhanger and no one quite knows what's going to happen next. So the positives are we have a deal. So there was a great buoyant mood out of Brussels yesterday. But today it's back to brass tacks. It's back to whipping MPs to support Boris Johnson. As one headline put it here, Boris love bombs MPs in bid for Commons majority. So lots of ministers and MPs have been out giving interviews on radio and TV over the last 24 hours, including the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab. He's been warning MPs not to stand in the way of the deal.
Those that want to criticise or to block this deal will be holding Britain back. And I think it's only through this deal and through the leadership that the Prime Minister has shown that we can get Brexit done, but we can also get the country as a whole moving forward.
Sounds a bit like a threat of sorts. MPs voting in this special sitting of Parliament tomorrow, Orla, can Boris Johnson get the votes he needs?
Well, at this stage, it could actually go either way. By the way, they're calling it Super Saturday, just to add another annoying term that they've come up with in our...
Yeah, got to brand it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. In our Brexit jargon. So yesterday evening when they were counting votes, they reckoned he was maybe 5 votes short. That appears to have changed in the last 24 hours because 9 Labour MPs are indicating that they might back Boris Johnson's deal. Now, they will back the deal because they either supported Leave themselves or they come from very strong Leave constituencies. Basically, Boris Johnson's biggest problem, and it's been his problem for some time, is the Northern Irish Party that supports the government, the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party. They came out yesterday when the deal was announced and said that they couldn't support the deal, and they have been appealing to MPs to vote against the deal. Here's the party's Brexit spokesman, Sammy Wilson.
This deal goes against everything, first of all, that the government promised they would not do to Northern Ireland, i.e. siphoning us off from the rest of the United Kingdom, putting a border down the Irish Sea, and at the same time, I mean, this is the insult to injury, overturning all of the safeguards which there are in the Belfast Agreement.
So if the MPs approve the deal tomorrow, that puts the UK on the road towards Brexit on October 31st. But what if the vote fails?
Well, here again, we're back to the guesswork. So if he loses the vote, he is obliged by law, which was passed here in Parliament in September, to go back to the EU and ask for an extension until January 31st. And he has said he will obey that law. But remember, we said it before, he has also said we will leave on the 31st of October, deal or no deal. And he has continued to say that over the last few days as well. So nobody quite knows what he plans to do in that circumstance. It is possible, by the way, that the EU, if he even went to the EU to ask for an extension, that they might refuse to give an extension. And it was interesting this afternoon, the French President Emmanuel Macron, he said he believed there was no need for a further extension.
Je pense que le délai du 31 octobre doit être tenu.
Macron has always been a hardline EU leader when it comes to dealing with the UK and dealing with Brexit. One imagines that he is saying this in order to persuade MPs in Parliament to vote for the deal tomorrow. And it does no harm to Boris Johnson to have people like Macron coming out today saying, you know, we don't need an extension. The deal needs to get through. We don't need to negotiate this again and again and again. But with the EU, it's always a little of never say never.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Finally today, a story with legs, lots of them. A researcher in Brazil has named four species of spiders after heavy metal musicians. Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden is one of them. Def Leppard's Rick Allen is another. This stroke of genius came from Christina Reams. She studies spiders at the Butantan Institute in Sao Paulo. Reams says she's a headbanger herself, and she was inspired by the Brazilian heavy metal singer André Matos. He died unexpectedly at the age of 47 this past June.
He was a singer that I actually met once or twice when I was an adolescent. And I did follow his career and I liked the type of music he played. And he was kind of my age. So when he died, so suddenly it was like, whoa. And I decided that I'd like to honor him with a spider species.
That particular spider is one of four species in a related group or genus. And to build on the idea, she paid tribute to some of her other heavy metal favorites.
Kind of music I like and I usually listen to, and Scorpions I've always listened to, and I really like Iron Maiden, and I do like Def Leppard, and I've always wanted to honor Rick Allen because I think he's kind of an example. I mean, you have a drummer that loses an arm. He learns how to play with only one arm, so I think he's kind of an example. So he's one of the extraordinaries as well.
Part of Reams' job is mapping different spider species and how they're related. Reams classifies spiders that she finds in the wild and in museum collections, so she has to come up with a lot of names. But Reams says one of the perks of her job is that while there are some rules she has to follow, she gets a lot of say in the matter.
You can be creative. I mean, they give you this amount of freedom to create names. For my Amazonian specimens, I got all the main characters from the Brazilian legends. And then I had another genus from Mexico, and I decided to go with demons. So I like researching and looking for interesting names.
And as for her heavy metal muses themselves, they're pretty excited. At least one of them is. The lead singer of Scorpions, Klaus Meine, gave his approval for the use of his name. He actually tipped his hat to her on Facebook.
He got pretty excited and he actually asked me for a certificate, an official certificate with the paper and everything. So I even joke around that he has my autograph now.
Rocking out with eight legs. Think about all the crazy dances. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman wishing you a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.